Leon de Grel, and most of the information in this presentation is from his wartime autobiography called Campaign in Russia, the Waffen-SS on the Eastern Front. He was born on June the 15th, 1906, in the town of Bouillon, in the Wallonia region of Belgium, into a family of devout Catholics. Bouillon is overlooked by Bouillon Castle, which once belonged to Godfrey of Bouillon, leader of the First Crusade and King of Jerusalem. In 1921, at the age of 15, he entered the Jesuit College of Notre-Dame de la Paix at Namur. At that age, he also started writing newspaper articles for Catholic publications. Next, he studied at the Catholic University of Louvain for a law doctorate, but also studying philosophy and literature there. In 1927, he assumed the direction of the student newspaper L'Avant-Garde, which, under his guidance, reached an unprecedented circulation of 10,000 copies. 2 years later, de Grel was offered an editorship of the Brussels daily newspaper Le XXe siècle, the 20th century, which he accepted as the agreement allowed him to continue his studies at the same time. And then in 1930, he was appointed director of Les Éditions Rex, a publishing house closely affiliated with the Catholic youth movement in Belgium. And Rex is the Latin for king and refers to Christ the King. At the age of 24, he was already an influential opinion leader and journalist in Belgium. Young Catholics started to rally to de Grel and the banner of Rex. And the story that then developed in the political landscape of Belgium is all too familiar to us, probably. De Grel and the Rexists pointed out the financial and moral corruption of the ruling powers. De Grel is credited by some even to have coined the term banksters. He certainly made it popular. He pointed out to the Belgian people that 59 Catholic deputies of the National Assembly held 245 positions on the boards of banking, industrial and commercial concerns, that 19 liberal deputies held 113 such positions, and that 17 socialists, all of them Marxists, held 53 of these. He also remarked on how the ruling parties were only able to hang on to power by fostering political division and strife. And the Belgian people actually began to wake up to reality. Because when the Rexist party first ventured into the election process in 1936, they had a stunning success. 21 deputies and 12 senators from the movement were elected. The establishment reacted by uniting all the parties from the extreme left to the so-called conservatives in a massive front against the only party that had the best interests of the whole nation at heart. The controlled mainstream press and even the Catholic hierarchy in the person of Cardinal Van Rooy joined this front. Catholics were forbidden by him from even abstaining from voting for the establishment candidate for prime minister, Paul van Zeeland. And of course, that made him, Zeeland, win the elections. A year later, he was, however, forced from office in the spring of 36 because de Grel had publicized the details of a financial scandal in which van Zeeland was involved in. After the usual damage control and spinning by the mainstream media, though, he was reinstated by June. The Van Zeeland government then declared martial law and brutally suppressed the Rexists. After the war, Van Zeeland was one of the founders of the European League for Economic Cooperation, which promoted the forming of what we know today as the EU. He was also honorary secretary general of the steering committee of the Bilderberg Group. And if you just heard an echo when I said Bilderberg Group, then it was all in your mind. In the mid to late 1930s, de Grel met with Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini, José Antonio Primo de Rivera of the Spanish phalanx, and Corneliu Zelea Codreanu of the Romanian Iron Guard. Then, when the German army advanced into Belgium to get to France after France had declared war on Germany, bypassing the Maginot Line, de Grelle was arrested by the Belgians as a suspected collaborator, beaten and tortured, and he and dozens of other Belgian political prisoners were sent to France. The only reason de Grelle survived the following massacre at Abbeville, where French army soldiers murdered these prisoners without any sort of trial, was that the French soldiers had recognized him on the lorries and had taken him off the convoy to beat him up. The convoy continued without de Grelle, and he was put into a French concentration camp instead. After Germany had won the France campaign, he was liberated by the Germans and able to go home to Belgium. And then, later, when the war against the Soviet Union started, de Grelle decided to join the fight. He had been ardently anti-Bolshevik anyway and saw how dangerous the aggressively expanding Soviet Union was for Europe. And his offer to raise a volunteer battalion of his Walloons, remember, he came from the Wallonia region of Belgium, for the struggle in the East, was accepted by the Germans. Until that point, de Grelle had never fired a gun and had no military training at all. The offer by the Germans to give him a high rank from the start was declined by him, and he insisted on starting out as a rank-and-file soldier, sharing all the burdens of his comrades. He and his men arrived at the Eastern Front in November 1941. They were immediately impressed by the sheer size of the Ukrainian steppe and also by the gigantic amount of war material that was either lying destroyed near the roadside or in the fields or had been captured intact from the fleeing Bolshevik army. Another shock to them was when they witnessed what the actual progress of the Soviet state was when it came to providing housing and infrastructure for the citizens. And this, by the way, is an impression I have come across again and again while reading these wartime biographies. When they came to the Ukrainian city Dnipropetrovsk, they saw that what de Grelle describes in his own words here, and it's going to be a rather long quote, but I think it's quite informative. Quote, at Dnipropetrovsk, the Stalin regime had made great efforts in construction. We were at first impressed as we approached the suburbs of the city, where we saw outlined the large masonry blocks of the proletarian housing erected by the Soviets. Their lines were modern, the buildings were huge, and there were many of them. Undeniably, the communist system had done something for the people. If the misery of the peasants was great, at least the workers seemed to have benefited from the new times. Still, it was necessary to visit and examine the buildings. We lived for 6 months in the Donetsk coal basin. We had plenty of time to test the conclusions that we had reached at the time of our entrance into Dnipropetrovsk. The buildings, so impressive from a distance, were just a gigantic hoax, intended to fool sightseers, shepherded by in-tourists and the viewers of documentary films. Approaching these housing blocks, you were sickened by the stench of mud and excrement which rose from the quagmires surrounding each of the buildings. Around them were neither sidewalks nor gravel nor paving stones. The Russian mud was everywhere. And everywhere the walls peeled and crumbled. The quality of the construction materials was of the lowest order. All the balconies had come loose and already the cement stairways were worn and grooved, although the buildings were only a few years old. Each floor had a certain number of apartments that were whitewashed and provided with a minuscule kitchen for the use of several families. The electric wiring hung in clusters. The walls were made of mud and cracked as soon as you dared to pound a nail into them. Generally, there was no running water. The proletarian dwellers, not able to use the sanitary facilities, relieved themselves all around the buildings, converted as a result into a vast latrine. Cold weather froze the droppings, which with each thaw caused a terrible stench. Altogether, those apartments turned out to be more uncomfortable than the miserable izbas in which, that's a Ukrainian word, it's like a peasant's hut, izba, in which on the richest soil in Europe, millions of Russian peasants vegetated in the midst of a sordid misery. Only tattered clothes on their backs, eating from a common bowl using spoons crudely carved from bits of wood. 75% of our soldiers were manual laborers. Many among them had been susceptible once to Soviet propaganda. They stood with their mouth agape when they saw in what condition of decay and exhaustion the Russian proletariat existed. They shook their heads, having to look twice at the scene before believing it. Hitler had tried a dangerous experiment. The hundreds of thousands of German workers mobilized and sent to the Eastern Front could have made dangerous comparisons if the Soviets had actually achieved great things for the working class. On the contrary, every German thought back to his delightful workers' housing in the Reich, to its comfort, to the family garden, to the clinics and maternity hospitals for the people, the leisure time, the paid vacations, the magnificent cruises to Scandinavia or to the Mediterranean. They remembered their wives, their children, happy, in good health, well-clothed. Looking at the ragged Russian people, the miserable izbas, the workers' apartments, gloomy and rickety, they drew clear conclusions. Never had workers' group made such a study trip. 4 years later, the comparison worked in the opposite direction. After having looted the watches, the jewelry, the clothes from all of Eastern Europe, the Soviet soldier returned grumbling to the USSR, astonished at the comfort of the non-communist countries and disgusted with his paradise of wooden spoons, tattered dresses and muddy excrement stretching around his house barracks. End quote.
That's pretty shocking, isn't it? Really, really shocking. That's like third world conditions. That's, you know, like India, where they just don't have any latrines and just go outside. It sounds to me like that's almost like a Hollywood film set from the Wild West with a cardboard cutout intended to just deceive people that it's a street, that it's buildings. So that was put there for journalists, I suppose. Maybe also for the advancing army, so that they would think that there was lots of people living there. And it's not something you really think of a government doing, is it, really?
Yes, and actually, de Grel, what he says, he uses the word, it was made for in tourists. That is that was the Soviet organization responsible for the tourist industry, if they had any, you know, ferrying it out to tourists, showing them only what they're allowed to see. So this was made for those who, came to Russia to get an impression, but they were, of course, never let close to the houses or even into them.
Yeah, that's really shocking. We'll deal with a part of that later on when we look at part 19 of Communism by the Back Door. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that last bit, or have you got any more to go? Schmidt, is there more to go from your piece this week?
Yes, not long, a few minutes, 2-3 minutes.
Okay, maybe we'll comment after that if you'd like to continue.
All right. He also talks about the peasants he encountered in the small villages and the abject poverty in which they lived. Almost all of the better-off farmers had been sent to the labor camps in Siberia. Despite the persecution of Christians, however, these poor peasants clung to Christianity as best they could. All the churches de Grel came across in his years at the front were desecrated, used as stables, garages, or storage places. For the first few months, the balloons were serving behind the front lines, guarding against partisan attacks and sabotage. After winter had set in, the first combat casualties among de Grel's men occurred when they were ordered to attack Soviet bunkers across a frozen river. They did take the bunkers, but as I said, he lost a number of his comrades there. In spite of the horrors, misery, and toils of that war, de Grel had a remarkable ability to perceive beauty. And as one of his talents lay in writing, he was able to describe it very well and in poetic manner. And as a quick example, quote, "Nevertheless, the country was still pleasant to see. The great white steppe was cross-hatched with hundreds of thousands of gray sunflower stalks. Clouds of sparrows, like little balls of fleece, fluttered madly aloft. The sky especially was admirable, as pure as crystal, pale blue, so clear that each tree's bare branches were outlined against the horizon with a sharpness worthy of the Acropolis in Athens," end quote. And well, with that impression, I have come to the end of the first part. Next week, we will hear more about what he experienced at the Eastern Front.
Yeah, that's certainly shocking conditions that the communists were in. To go back to the beginning there, with the beginning of his life, was he always a nationalist? Or was he inspired by what he saw happening in Germany? Did he start out like that?
Well, he was primarily a Catholic and patriot, yes. And I have read no indication that he ever fell for leftist or liberal ideologies. He seems to have been straightforward. If you are Catholic, you are naturally conservative. But I think he was, from start, he was very patriotic. And he was anti-Bolshevik from early age on as well.
And yet the Catholics tried to ban people from joining him, despite the fact that he was quite proud of his Catholic beliefs. And the organization that he formed was Catholic as well, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And, he got into the trouble because he pointed out that the Catholics were also involved in the corruption in Belgium, political corruption, having all I don't know the technical term, but they were responsible for industry and banking administration, and they were bribeable through that. They were corruptible through that. He pointed that out, and many different scandals he pointed out in his newspaper publications. Of course, the people in power didn't like that, whether they were Catholic or not.
Well, so it's interesting to find out that there was more to him than just the guy that fought in the Waffen-SS and survived the war and spoke about National Socialist Germany. It's interesting to hear about his life leading up to that point. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that?
Yeah, well, like I said earlier, he's my all-time favourite general. There's some quite interesting videos on YouTube that I urge people to go and listen to, because the guy wanted to escape to Spain after the war, did some excellent reviews on National Socialism and the SS, etc. And it doesn't come as no surprise to me that he didn't want the luxury of going into the army at a higher rank, and instead went in as a foot soldier, very similar to Adolf Hitler, who did the same in World War One. And this, of course, is the guy who Adolf Hitler stated that if he ever had a son, then Leon de Grel, he was likened to be just like Leon de Grel, which is an absolute wonderful statement coming from Le Führer.
Yeah, that's quite an honour. It's interesting to hear that he met Mussolini and Hitler and Codriano, and I dare say a few other leaders of nationalist movements at the time. You think today it's you get to meet the people that do lead these movements. You know, they're real people that want to meet other nationalists. They're not like these politicians that hide away, that don't want to meet the people, that have all these bodyguards in front of them, or in the case of Obama, a great big tank and a bulletproof wall in front of them. And these people wanted to meet the people that they were fighting for. They were like the focal point of the nation. I believe they would channel the energy of that nation into trying to achieve something positive for it. And I thought another interesting part there that you brought up, Schmidt, was the corrupt politician that was part of Belgium before the war, and then after the war was one of the architects of the EU. I think that just shows you that the plan for the European Union goes way back. It goes back to before the war, and that they just seized upon the fallout after the war as a good means to use in order to bring about the EU, to use that as the excuse, saying, well, we need the European Union to ensure that we always have peace between the countries. Whereas the real planning for it was to have an overarching government of unelected bureaucrats working for the bankers, really, over a slave class. So it shows you that it was planned right the way from the beginning. Why they let him back in after he was found to be corrupt, I don't know. Maybe they said that it was just Nazi slurs against him or something like that. Do you know more about that character at all, Schmidt?
Not really. I did research him a little, but most of what I could find was on Wikipedia. And I don't know what the exact financial scandal was and how the press exactly spun it so that he could be reinstated later. But obviously it was serious enough that he had to resign. And well, probably the mainstream media worked very similarly back then as it does today. So they just spun the whole story. And a lot of people had forgotten about it, they just reinstated him, is what I am guessing happened.
Yeah, like a lot of the crooks and the criminals of World War II that were removed from their positions by the National Socialists and the Nationalist regimes after the war, they came back and they were given all the plum positions, like in East Germany. And some of them were even involved in the Nuremberg court on the side of the prosecutors, where they shouldn't have been, where you're not supposed to judge any case that actually involves yourself in it. And the point I was going to refer to about the conditions that the communists were living in, I thought that that bore some relevance to part 19 of Communism by the Backdoor, Dennis, where you had that letter that was sent out saying that they were going to cover up the crimes of the Red Army. And admitting that they knew that these crimes actually did take place. But you had this Stafford Cripps, the ambassador to the Soviet Union, saying there was no wish to interfere in any other country. I mean, he had obviously been out there in the Soviet Union, and he must have been shown these false house fronts. He must have known about them, and yet he blatantly lied to the people. I thought that was a really interesting part from that. I'd urge everyone to go out and see part 19.
We are again with the Grell in the winter of 1941-42. And what the German soldiers and their European allies had to endure in these winters at the Eastern Front is probably unimaginable for virtually all of us. The temperatures were usually dozens of degrees Celsius below freezing point. In de Grel's own words, anyone who took off his gloves for a moment immediately had his fingers frozen. We wore our winter caps pulled up to our noses. Our breath, passing through them, was frozen into large tufts of ice at the level of our mouth, and into long white mustaches fastened to our eyebrows. Our tears themselves froze, becoming large pearls which painfully welded our eyelashes together. We separated them only with great pain. At any moment, a nose or a cheek might become pale yellow, like the skin of a drum. In order to avoid frostbite, we had to rub the flesh vigorously with snow. Often, it was already too late. End quote. And because of the difficulties of supplying the soldiers in that frozen hell, they were at that time usually only given a loaf of bread for provision per day. No horse cart could be provided for de Grel and his comrades, nor any motorized vehicle. When they went on extended patrols or were ordered to move from one area of the front to another, they were just on their own. They had to march. And de Grel was a machine gunner at that time, and he had to carry a load of more than 40 kilograms on his back. 30 of those were for the machine gun and the cartridge boxes. When they did have means of transportation available, for example, when German engineers fixed a railway line that had been destroyed by the fleeing Bolsheviks. That usually wasn't that much better either. In one instance, for example, they had to use a snowplow locomotive to get most of the snow cleared from the rails. Advancing for 20 kilometers like this took them 14 hours. The cars that were attached were, of course, unheated. The temperature was 42 degrees Celsius below zero. And in order not to freeze to death, they had to continuously run one behind the other inside the car. One of their comrades was too exhausted to continue and lay down in a corner. When the others saw this, they thought he was sleeping and wanted to wake him up, but he did not react. They stopped the train and gathered up some snow, rubbing him with it for 50 minutes. Then they at least finally managed to get some sign of life back into him. However, the poor fellow was confined to a hospital for a year and lost all his teeth. It may sound kind of strange to rub someone who suffers from severe hypothermia with snow, but from everything I've read, this is the right thing to do. De Grel's machine gun hopelessly jammed at temperatures of minus 40 degrees. The only possible defense that remained was close combat with knives and grenades. And again, amazingly, De Grel managed to perceive beauty and even experience bliss under these conditions. Personally, I think that was only possible because of his faith. I'm going to quote something he wrote about that. At 6 o'clock in the morning, a dazzling dawn arose, spreading across the sky, gold, orange, purple, reddish purple with some soft moss, bordered with clear silver. As I looked at the sky with rapturous eyes at that breathtaking tableau, Aurora's violet bounty festooned above the empty steppe. I cast aside my sufferings and felt love. The most important thing is beauty at any cost. I saw above me the most beautiful lights in the world. I had once contemplated the sky in Athens. My emotion, my joy were even greater as I looked at the sumptuousness and clarity of that Russian sky. My nose was frozen, my cheek was frozen. My machine gun was all ice, but all of my feelings were on fire. End quote. The weather was also extremely unpredictable. At the beginning of February 1942, it was 42 degrees below zero, and 4 days later, the roads were rivers 30 centimeters or 1 foot deep. The inhumane cruelty of the Bolsheviks, however, was usually very predictable. For one example, I will quote De Grel again. It was there that, inspecting the slope that went downward toward the Samara, I believed that I could make out a body in the melting snow. I went down to have a look. To my horror, I discovered a young German whose legs the Russians, especially sadistic, had sawed off at the knees. The job had been done with a butcher's saw, unquestionably by an expert. The unfortunate German had been part of a reconnaissance patrol which had disappeared 2 days earlier. It was obvious that after his mutilation, he had still dragged himself 15 meters with the desperate will of a young man who didn't want to die. End quote. De Grel was wounded around that time for the first time as well. When Soviet airplanes attacked them, his foot was injured and the bones fractured in two places. The idea was then to get him to a hospital, but that idea was not to the liking of De Grel, who wanted to stay with his comrades. He had the ambulance man put him on a horse-drawn sled, and after an hour he had caught up with his company. On the 17th of February 1942, De Grel and his Walloons reached the plateau that they had been ordered to take and hold, as it overlooked the Samara Valley and was therefore of tactical importance. There was a village on the plateau called Kromovaya Balka, and his men spent there what he calls days of hell. They were greeted by an extremely fierce artillery barrage by the Soviets. Many comrades fell before they were even able to occupy the village. The village on that plateau itself was actually in a slight depression, so the balloons set up their positions on the ridge. They were not able, however, to dig in. The soil was hard as granite. They constructed their defenses from large blocks of frozen snow, hewn with axes. They found two cases of French cognac in the manure heaps in the village, which the Soviets had hidden there before they fled. But that could not in any way make up for the 10 days of hell that they would spend there. As usual, the Bolsheviks had massacred all the animals of the village before they fled. Once they were reinforced and outnumbered the balloons considerably, they started to probe the plateau day and night. And throughout these 10 days, none of the balloons were able to sleep more than an hour and a half at a time. The Grell himself was lying there in one of the huts of the village because of his broken foot, nearly freezing to death. In the space of a few days, the Soviets fired several thousands of artillery shells at their position. The Soviets decided to first take a village that was held by soldiers of the Waffen-SS, Viking Division, some 3 kilometers from the plateau, so they would have an easier approach to it, to the plateau. The Grell's impression of the Waffen-SS soldiers there reads as follows. The SS were around 200 in number. They were real heavyweights. Our men who kept contact with their command post could not get over their coolness under fire. The Russians were within 30 meters, machine gunning them from house to house. In one day, the SS withstood 10 assaults by an enemy 20 times more numerous. They resisted, immovable, playing cards at each respite. At the end of a week, they held only a narrow passageway, 100 meters wide, leading to the west. 3/4 of these courageous men had fallen in the struggle. On February 28, 1942, at 5 in the morning, several thousand Reds pounced on the 50 or so survivors. The Germans suffered an hour's savage massacre. Only a few managed to escape. We saw them running towards us across the snow, followed closely by the Bolsheviks. They came just in time to help us, for even as the Vikings' village was being overrun, hordes of the Soviet troops, which had massed to the east of Gromo via Balka the night before, flooded towards us. At 6 o'clock in the morning, two regiments consisting of 4,000 men attacked us, supported by 14 tanks. There were barely 500 of us, and we had a single tank, end quote. The hut in which de Grell had been lying caught fire, and hopping on one foot, he saw through the windows that his men were being overwhelmed. His foot had had 2 weeks to mend, so he kicked off the splint and limped towards his comrades, using his rifle as a crutch. The balloons and the surviving SS men fought with incredible bravery. They made the Bolsheviks pay dearly for every meter of territory that they gained. Faced with extremely overwhelming numerical superiority and firepower, instead of faltering, the balloons started to strike up their old Rexist songs in defiance and sang as they leapt to the attack. The Bolsheviks, on the other hand, used their tanks for a monstrous manhunt, wheeling around the huts and crushing any wounded balloon or SS man that could not get out of the way. After having been forced back to a last retreat, the Grell and his comrades were preparing to meet their death. But for a last quote today, here is what happened at that moment. Neither of us was about to die, however. All at once, we heard the roar of engines overhead. And tanks were blowing up. ISPAs were exploding. Whole bunches of Reds were tossed in the air like ragdolls. The Stukas had arrived. With incredible precision, they hit the Soviet tanks dead center and flattened the attackers, who stupidly crowded together in bunches as usual. The enemy tanks fled in great haste to escape the diving planes' cannon fire. The infantry took off right behind them. Our battalion commander immediately threw the last forces that he had into a counterattack. The wave surged past us. By noon, the Wallonian Legion had completely retaken Gromovaya Balka, reconquering even the first isbas on both sides of the pond. End quote. The struggle at that village was not yet completely over, but my presentation for today is. I hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, that was quite moving. I mean, that's quite incredible, these odds that they were facing there. When you think tanks and however many thousand of them that were outside, there's only 500 of them. He's there with a broken leg that's been broken for the last 2 weeks, hobbling over there on using his gun as a crutch. And you just don't ever have to put up with things like that in the modern world, really, as part of Europe. I suppose in Siberia, Serbia, when that was bombed, they probably saw some or felt some similar things to that. But we just, you know, we lead such cushioned lives, I think, nowadays, that things like that, we can't really imagine them. And I find it interesting there when you were saying about the snow, rubbing the snow into people's faces. You think how cold that must be. You know, I know some of our listeners live in the north. But I mean, being here in Britain, it doesn't really get much lower than about minus 10. And that's really cold. So if you think that was minus 40, where everything is freezing up, and then you think, well, these Russians actually lived in that. And in even colder areas. And that makes me just think about, you know, just how incredible the white man is, that he can live in these inhospitable areas on the planet and can actually build a civilization there and a city there. And it just makes me think of places like Iceland and Finland and Greenland, and how we can live in the coldest areas of the world, and also in the hottest areas as well. You know, we can colonize anywhere, and with our ingenuity, that's how we managed to do it. I mean, it was their ingenuity that meant that they could live out there in the cold. It wasn't like they had extra thick skin to keep them warm or anything like that. You know, physical adaptations. It was all mental adaptations that they made and skills that they'd learned in order to be able to do that. And so for these Walloons to be going there from a temperate zone like Belgium, and to then suddenly be there in that freezing cold, I mean, that makes it all the more of a challenge. You know, it's like fighting against somebody on their, or playing a game against somebody on their home ground or on their home turf. But 10 times more extreme than that. He's quite an incredible chap, Leon de Grel. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that?
Yeah, I'd just like to say I can understand why soldiers, I mean, the Russians did it when they went into Afghanistan, carry this one last bullet, because the last thing I particularly want is somebody to saw my legs off while still being alive.
Yeah, that's another really shocking thing, and the way that they treated the animals. Butchering all the animals. I mean, was that because they didn't want them used as provisions by the ones following, do you think?
I think that's possible, but I think there's just a streak in him that was just psychopathic. Gotta be.
A sadistic streak. I mean, sawing the legs off. Schmidt, I believe there was lots of other things like that as well that you found when you were researching, and that was just one instance of it, wasn't it?
Yes, there is a lot of it in his wartime biography, and I spared you some of it, or most of it, actually. Some descriptions also of horrible war wounds that were inflicted by these exploding bullets that the Russians used, and of course artillery shell wounds and all that. And there's some really nasty stuff about the vermin that they had to deal with, lice and all kinds of vermin, rats that ate the corpses of the dead and so on.
Oh, you can just imagine it, them hanging around somebody who's just on their last legs and trying to go for them as they're dropping off to sleep. Yeah, you can just imagine what that must have been like. Really horrific. Where did you get us up to last time in your presentation?
Well, last week we had stopped at the moment where, well, after the providential attack of the Stukas, the Walloons and the remaining SS men reconquered that village, Gromovaja Balka.
I think I remember that now. Well, do you want to continue from there?
Yes, and by the way, I found satellite images of that village. And it still looks quite like the Grell describes it, with the two ponds and the buildings on either side of the ponds. So if people want to look that up, I actually posted the link to it on the Daily Stormer comments beneath our re-upload of this show there.
And that's not the ones with the cardboard cutout buildings? Like,
no.
This different one.
No, I don't think they still have those under Putin now. Yeah. I think those times are gone.
Yeah, thank God. Okay, well, please continue then.
Okay, so they had taken a lot of prisoners, Mongols, Kyrgyz, and Siberians. And those were quite flabbergasted at the fighting spirit of the Walloons and the SS. And they kept repeating, Belgijski Karoch, Belgijski Karoch, which means Belgians, famous. And, well, all of the wounded Belgians and SS were dead, as they were deliberately crushed by the Soviets with their tanks, as I mentioned last week. And the rest were killed with bayonet thrusts. A while after the Stukas had left, the Soviets came back at them again. They still had a huge numerical advantage, and some of their tanks had survived the Stuka attack. The Grell's men had no anti-tank weapons. The Panzerfaust had not yet been developed. They started arriving at the front in 1943. Nor did they have any anti-tank gun. The German 100th Jäger Division had been sent to support the Walloons in their struggle, but a German panzer column that was supposed to clear the way for them ran into a large group of Soviet tanks, and the ensuing battle, which lasted for hours, delayed the reinforcements. So the Walloons and the SS were on their own again. They were forced back by the approaching tanks and overwhelming numbers of the Soviets. They defended each hut and each barn as long as they could, but eventually the survivors were gathered at the last houses in the southwestern corner of the village. If they were forced out of these last strongholds, they would be thrown out into the steppe, flat, without a bush, covered by deep snow, with no cover at all. They would be, in other words, doomed. The commander of the Walloons, Captain Pauly, gathered together the remains of all the companies and grenade in hand, was the first to rush to the counterattack, shouting their old cry, Rex will win.
Rex, back on.
All who could still fight followed, including the armorers, the cooks, and the truck drivers. They darted from hut to hut, avoiding the Soviet tanks, which were running out of shells to fire, engaged the Soviet infantry in hand-to-hand combat inside the huts, or firing at them at point-blank range. The Soviets panicked and were exhausted. First they hesitated, and then they began to give ground. And then, in the thick of the hand-to-hand combat, some German infantry reinforcements appeared in the snow to the west, and the Panzer, victorious in the battle with the Soviet tanks, showed up on the crest of a hill. The enemy rout was then complete. For a third time, the village had been retaken. Night was about to fall, and 700 Soviets were lying dead, scattered all across the village. But 250 Walloons and SS had become casualties as well, killed or severely wounded during those 12 hours of furious fighting. And to quote de Grell again, "For 10 days we had gotten our bearings and had worked hard. We had held on to the village in spite of 4,000 Soviet soldiers and 14 tanks, only because the honor of our people was at stake. All of us preferred death to giving ground. A burning patriotism inspired our soldiers. They were representing their country. For it, half of our men had fallen, frozen in death, bathed in blood. Only national pride had enabled the miracle of three counterattacks and the reconquest. Many of the surviving wounded were hit the second time when the medical convoy evacuating them, clearly marked as such, was fired upon by the Soviets. By the morning of the 2nd of March of 1942, the Wallonian Legion had been reduced to less than a third of its original strength. Out of 26 officers, there remained two, one of whom, suffering a nervous breakdown, was evacuated a short time later. But tales of the heroism of the Walloons were now spreading all along the Donetsk front. The commander of the 100th Jäger Division had awarded them 33 Iron Crosses, and they were honored by being mentioned in the Wehrmachtbericht, or Wehrmacht Report, of the day. Die Grell doesn't mention in his book that he was one of the recipients, but I looked up his decorations, and the date for his Iron Cross Second Class matches that given date. During the Battle of Gromovaya Balka, he was promoted from corporal to non-commissioned officer, according to the English translation. And he states, quote, "I love the life of a soldier, simple as could be, free of worldly concerns, ambitions, and interests," end quote. Now, getting shot at all the time seems quite a worldly concern to me, but I guess what he means is that life was very basic and simple. They did not have to worry about daily things, superficial and vain things like fashion or career or otherwise necessary things like politics. And here again, I come to a part which I find interesting. What did the soldiers discuss amongst themselves? And I'm again quoting. "We often received visits from our German comrades. We would even go to spend the evening in their shelters. For hours we would discuss the problems of the post-war period. Beside the dead, what would there be? The questions about frontiers, about material affairs, didn't interest us very much. Living ceaselessly face to face with death, we came to understand to an intense degree the importance of spiritual forces. The front held only because at the front there were souls, souls which believed, which burned with ardor, which radiated strength. Our victories were won not only with weapons, but with virtues. The problems of the post-war period would be identical. Economic victories would not be enough. Political reorganizations would not be enough. A great moral redemption would be necessary, which would cleanse away the blemishes of our time, which would restore our souls with the fresh air of passion and of unconditional service. National revolution, yes. Social revolution, yes. European revolution, yes. But above all else, a spiritual revolution is 1,000 times more necessary than external order, than external justice, than fraternity in words alone. The world emerging from the killing and the hatred of the war would need, first, pure hearts believing in their mission, dedicating themselves to it, pure hearts in whom the masses could believe and to whom they could devote themselves. Our discussions blazed to life like fires. A paltry little gas lamp emphasized the lines in our faces. Those faces radiated. That winter we offered up our sufferings for the purification of our dreams. Never had we felt in our hearts so much strength, so much clarity, so much joy. Once we had been able to lead commonplace lives soiled by petty abdications to daily necessity, the front had given us a taste for privation. We were purged of all hatred and of all desire. We had mortified our bodies, extinguished our ambition, purified and offered our sacrifice. Death itself no longer frightened us." End quote. Personally, I think this passage not only shows his idealism and political passion, but also his Catholic spirituality shining through clearly here. Now, Moving on to another subject, how the Germans, and in this specific case, the Belgians, interacted with the local population. If you remember how Hans Ulrich Rudel described his encounters with the Ukrainian and Russian civilians, you will find the following quote matches what he tells us. The natives received us with obvious joy. Often we were the first troops to enter their hamlet. The good people immediately went to the outbuildings, removed their icons from their former hiding places, and hung them once more on their dry mud walls, tears streaming down their faces. The greatest gift that one could confer on them was to give them a portrait of Hitler. Often they would hang it next to their icons. They would even put it between the photos of their boys, dressed in the uniform of the Soviet Army, red stars on their caps. Such photographic fraternization appeared perfectly natural to them. They loved their boys very much. They loved Hitler very much for having liberated their village. They combined the two. Very strict orders had been given that the troops be friendly with the population. End quote. And returning to another battle experience, I will quickly set the scene and then let de Grel himself again tell the story. The Walloons were now attached to the 97th Jäger Division. Its commanding officer, Lieutenant General Ernst Rupp, had sent the two infantry regiments of the division in different directions, and in between them he advanced, covered only by a general staff company. As de Grel puts it, these men had more specialists in pen pushing and rubber stamping than in machine guns and grenades. Everything seemed to be going great, but then suddenly the Soviets started coming out of hiding and cutting off the roads. They had walked into a trap. General Rupp and his small company were surrounded in the village of Shirvanskaya, which, by the way, can also be looked up on Google Maps. The old orderlies, the secretaries, the veterinarians, and the supply sergeants fought as well as they could, but the Soviets were closing in. The Soviets, occupied a high point at a crossroads and had established a formidable position there. The Walloons had received an urgent radio message ordering the Legion to cover, that same night, 20 kilometers of mountain and then hurl itself at the enemy, relieving the divisional command post at Shirvanskaya. It was a starless night, pitch black, and after an hour of marching, the Walloons found it impossible to continue. One of them had badly injured his back, and several horses had fallen into precipices hundreds of meters deep. At 2 in the morning, they resumed the march, and after long and exhausting hours of marching, they finally came to that forested hill where the enemy was entrenched in his positions. Oh, and by the way, this is in August, so and they had no summer daylight savings time, so at 2 o'clock in the morning, it would already slowly start to dawn, so they could keep moving. The Soviets had artillery, motorized transport, and some captured anti-tank guns. And now to the quote. The frontal attack promised to be lethal. Therefore, I took 3 volunteers, all of them expert in combat, while the companies advanced as well as they could. I threaded my way along the right flank, reaching some holly groves, then the forests, and succeeded in crawling between the first Russian posts. My 3 lads followed me at a distance of 10 meters. I wanted to flank the enemy. I arrived right behind him. I could see the Soviet camp through the branches. At that very moment, our men were scaling the slopes to attack the Reds. This was it. I leapt out behind the Bolsheviks, raking them with machine gun bursts and unleashing blood-curdling shouts. My companions stormed right behind me into the middle of the camp with a similar uproar. Panic reigned. The Reds, believing themselves cornered, ran about in circles, finally fleeing in utter confusion into the ravine to the southwest. They had gone completely mad. The 4 of us alone had chased them from their lair. All the trucks were ours, magnificent Ford trucks, drawn up in a square, he's still in the ignition. The cannons, which had shelters, were also in our hands, as well as 10 machine guns. Supplies, equipment, ammunition, helmets overflowing with fruit. Nothing was lacking. Our cries and our bursts of fire, exploding suddenly behind them, had been enough to convince several hundred Reds of disaster and to drive them across the plateau. We sped after them, howling all the louder and then shooting off all our machine gun clips. Shortly afterwards, one of our companies, arriving on the double, met us at the crossroads. End quote. And next week, we'll hear some more of Degrelle's daring adventures before we turn to the tale of how he survived the war and avoided capture.
Wow, that's... I mean, the first thing that really strikes me about that is the first battle that he was involved in, where they didn't have any anti-tank guns. The only tactic you can use then is to just dodge the bullets until the tanks actually run out of missiles to fire at you. I mean, that must have really been quite something. I do really appreciate you doing these presentations for us, Schmidt. I know our listeners do as well. It's fascinating hearing about these war heroes. I mean, you think of the odds that they were fighting against, 4,000 Soviets at one point there. In inhospitable conditions that they're not used to, but I guess it makes it all worth it when they liberate people and they liberate the people who they have liberated want to put pictures of Hitler up there amongst their religious icons. I mean, today we ridicule and we mock the Middle East for showing their pictures of Bashar al-Assad and when they used to show up these pictures of Muammar Gaddafi. The BBC and the news, they always used to mock them and say, oh, these dictators, everybody's forced to hold up these pictures of them. But they're not forced to hold these pictures up of them. You know, when you have a good leader who really does his best for the people, really does give real social justice to the people and lets them own their own homes and raises them up out of poverty, then the people are really pleased about this, and they genuinely do love their leaders, just like we used to genuinely love some of our kings that we had, some of our monarchs. You know, when we would say God save the king, we really meant it. It's just that we in the West now, for so long now, we've had dreadful political leaders. We just can't understand that somebody would love the leader of their state as much as that. But it's obvious that these people that Degrelle liberated, they did, and Hitler wasn't even their leader. He was just the one that had liberated them from the Soviets. And I also found it interesting that he was talking about the fact that we need to have a spiritual revolution, and it was their pure hearts that actually saw them through the battle, and that's what kept them going at the front. And it doesn't matter what economic changes you want to make, what political changes you want to make, unless there is a change in spirit, then it will all come to nothing. And when you think about the absolute tragedy that was the Second World War, and we've never actually got over it, we've never had a chance to get over it because we've only ever been told lies about it. You know, we committed this absolute atrocity against our German brothers, and we've never been able to actually come to terms with that because 99% of our population don't even realise it. We don't even realise the injustice of what we did. We think that that they massacred 6 million Jews and they deserved it. Half of us don't even know about the firebombing of Dresden and what was actually done to Germany. And yet we were the ones that did that. We were the ones that were guilty of that. And we've never had a chance to actually come to terms with what we did to pay for our crimes because we don't even know that we did them. So, you know, when he was saying there that that's what we need is a spiritual revolution and pure hearts, we've never had a chance to actually have that, which is why we ended up with the European Union, and we ended up in the state that we're in today, I think. Dennis, have you got any comments you'd like to make on that?
Yeah, well, I'm sure the listeners know that Leon Degrelle is my all-time favourite general. The thing which I found fascinating was when he said that they'd come to terms with being on the front and they'd actually purified themselves. And so what you're talking about here is that actually the dead can't die. They've kind of committed themselves to they're already dead. They're purified. They've made their word with God. And so, you know, let the battle commence. a mindset which is a nightmare for the enemy.
They're actually absolutely fearless of dying. There's nothing more that can be held over them. You know, that's what faith does, isn't it? You know, because people have faith that they're fighting for the correct cause. If they do die, there's life that carries on after death. So they are going to be fearless. Yeah, this is what the people used to fight for. They weren't fighting for wages. They were fighting because they thought that they were fighting on the right side, on both sides of the war. This was true. And it wasn't just Leon de Grelde and his men that believed that they were fighting on God's side. The British did as well. The Allies thought they were fighting on God's side. It was just these evil people at the top that knew what was really going on, that it was just a war for the bankers. And we see this fearless behaviour even in ISIS, don't we? Because they think they're going to go off to paradise with all their virgins afterwards. I mean, they're quite happy to blow themselves up.
At a young age as well,
yeah? Yeah, the power of actually having a faith and having a religion is something that we just seem to have forgotten nowadays. I mean, atheists, they're not going to blow themselves up for some abstract idea. They're not going to go and put their lives on the line for some abstract idea of democracy or freedom for homosexuals to bugger one another in the streets. You know, they're not going to lay down their lives to fight for that. But yeah, people are going to lay down their lives to fight if they think they're fighting for their God, or if they think they're fighting against the enemies of their God, then they're willing to do that. And this is the strength that we had that enabled us to go out on these crusades, I think, in the past. It's also the strength that enabled the British to defeat Julius Caesar. And he wrote that as well. He said that the British are so fierce because they believe in life after death. This is why they're such fierce fighters and fierce warriors. You know, it's so important that we actually have a faith. And Schmidt, have you got anything else that you'd like to add to that?
Yes, there's something. 6 days after this battle that I last described, he got the infantry assault badge in silver. And de Grelde doesn't mention that he got it or how he got it in his book, but I would think that daring assault had something to do with it. And also concerning what he wrote about this purification in battle, it must be something that is simply hard to imagine for us. But he seemed to have been in some ways happy at the front, and he found his strength in his faith, and there's no doubt about that. And yes, I guess a lot of the Soviet soldiers were raised, maybe they were raised at home with Christianity, but if they went to state school, it was probably, they were probably, re-educated. And so maybe that is partly the explanation as to why the Germans could rout thousands of Soviet soldiers with just a couple of hundred of German soldiers.
Well, I don't think the Soviets' heart was really in it. They'd had their whole country taken over by these Jewish revolutionaries. They weren't under any deception that they weren't Jewish revolutionaries. They knew that. Whereas in Britain, we didn't know that Winston Churchill was working for the Jews. The people that actually knew that had been locked up and silenced. And yet I think the Russians, most of them knew that these people that were bossing them about and telling them to go to war weren't actually Russian. They were Jews. And I think as a white man, you know, that's the purpose of our lives, is to fight for a just cause. Whether it's fighting to provide and protect for your family, or whether it's fighting to rectify some injustice. I think that's what all white men wish to do, and they find a purpose in themselves when they're doing that. You know, they feel morally justified in going to war and fighting to the last breath, because they believe it is for a just cause. Hey, this goes back to, you can look at the old the Mahabharata, the Indian war epic of the Aryan Hindus, and the Bhagavad Gita. It talks about the reasons for going to war, and in the end, you know, you think, well, lots of people are going to die. People on my side are going to die. People on their side are going to die. But if it's for a just cause, if it's morally right, then you have to fight for it. You know, we are in the midst of a battle between good and evil. And light and dark. And if we don't fight to defend the good, then the good gets snuffed out. You know, that's what it boils down to. And when we do that, we know that we've got God on our side, as you can see there with de Grel, but winning against all odds. You know, he had God on his side. You know, it's just a shame that it wasn't the right time for Hitler to actually win the war. You know, but at least they still had 10 years of living under National Socialist Germany, and we have that example which we can look to today in order to give us inspiration and to give us hope. It just wasn't quite at the right time. But if you think about it, you know, it was only Germany that really knew about, you know, the what the Jews had done, this Jewish conspiracy and this Jew world order. And yet, because of what they found out and what they wrote down and what they taught other people, the whole world knows about it now through the internet. So if it hadn't happened, you know, we wouldn't know that it was the Jews that were running us now. You know, Adolf Hitler's spirit really has risen from the grave and come back again, like he prophesied that it would. Anyway, thank you very much for that, Schmidt.
The constant fighting took its toll over time for de Grel and the Walloons. Not just the fighting, but times they had to hold out in hellish positions, surrounded by the decomposing corpses of the Soviet soldiers they had defeated earlier. They could not bury them or even move them, as they would immediately draw fire if they left their trenches or makeshift bunkers, and sometimes the earth was so frozen that they couldn't dig at all. And the lack of sleep didn't help either, of course. Sometimes they were just that they couldn't sleep at all because they were assaulted all night, had to fight, stay awake. And I'm of course leaving out a lot of the horrors they faced. It may seem strange to jump from incredible victory, as we heard last time, to total exhaustion, but many weeks of bitter fighting, losing many comrades and good friends, lay between these two extremes. As the Walloons had earned their reputation as fearless fighters, they were often ordered to attempt the most desperate assaults or defenses. By November 1942, the Walloonian Legion was at its end. In de Grel's words, "We were at the end. End of our physical strength, the end of our spiritual resources. We struggled on only because our honor as soldiers was on the line. Volunteers, we wanted to remain so until the bitter end, until the last beat of our exhausted hearts. We no longer hoped for anything. One morning, reading the orders, we stared with vacant eyes at a paragraph which named the hour and conditions for our relief. It took us a long time to understand. Nevertheless, it was really true. The Walloonian Legion was to return to Belgium. It would receive 3 weeks home leave, and there be reinforced by several thousand Belgian volunteers." End quote. 187 men was all that remained of the Walloonian Legion at this point. To jump a little ahead of the 6,000 Belgians who first volunteered and joined between the autumn of 1941 and the spring of 1945, 2,500 died in battle. 83% of them received one or more wounds. Of the first 800 volunteers, three alone of those who had taken part in all the battles reached the end of the war alive. A simple soldier, a junior officer who became a captain, wounded three times, and de Grel himself wounded on five occasions. While they were heading home to Belgium, de Grel saw what the German engineers and administrators had accomplished behind the front lines in the Ukraine. Quoting, "Since the union of the Ukraine with Europe, all this hinterland had become a fabulous construction yard. Where 1 year earlier we had found nothing but railroad lines, corroded thanks to the Soviet habit of letting everything go, and buildings blackened by systematic Soviet arson, we now saw modern railway stations with 15 or 20 lines, dotted with huge new buildings of concrete and brick. We gazed wide-eyed at this incredible transformation through the half-opened door of our car. Hundreds of billboards bearing the names of the principal German firms were posted proudly on the factories and hangars. Honors list of the conquerors in this industrial war. We, the soldiers, had conquered a wasteland which the Soviets had totally annihilated or wrecked piece by piece before retreating towards the east. German industry had needed only 14 months to rebuild, create, establish order, to transform everything from the ground up. Everywhere new stations, warehouses, huge sugar refineries had been built. We unloaded hundreds of agricultural machines, green and red, as smart as Nuremberg toys. In 1 year, Germany had created in Russia the richest colony in the world. Magnificent work. But also magnificent illusion, for the Reich squandered prematurely on this work of European peace the strength which, according to the jungle law of hatred and self-interest, should have been turned exclusively towards warlike works of carnage, of killing, of extermination. End quote. I find this a very interesting contrast. The Soviets have systematically starved the Ukrainians, killing millions in the process, sold the wheat on the international markets and used the money gained to build up a gigantic army before the start of the war. The Germans, on the other hand, during the war, facing that gigantic army, used a lot of their resources to rebuild the Ukraine and bring it into the 20th century, instead of using these resources to build tanks and bombers. I don't think de Grel is really saying here that he would have preferred it if that had been the case. He says, according to the jungle law of hatred and self-interest, this should have been done. But de Grel, from what I read and researched, was all about Christianity, high culture, and, well, the opposite of the jungle law, basically. At the end of January 1943, the Walloonian Legion had reassembled for a second departure at the Sports Palace in Brussels. Tens of thousands of Belgians were there to cheer them on. The working class made up three quarters of the Legion, but they also had many young men from the aristocracy and the Belgian upper class, sons of diplomats, civil servants, and businessmen. During that year, they went from battle to battle and kept increasing their fame. By November 1943, they were even integrated into the Waffen-SS. They were now called the Assault Brigade Wallonia and consisted of 2,000 combat-ready men, having 354 trucks and armored vehicles at their disposal. De Grel had earned the promotion to Obersturmführer and was made commander of the 3rd Company. Then, on Christmas Eve, just when the Walloons were singing O Holy Night, the Soviets attacked their position. And I'm going to quote here again. We leapt up, and in the snow, illuminated by shells, by tracer bullets, by the flash of cannon fire, by the red, green, and white flares of the signalers, we spent our Christmas Eve preventing a raging enemy from crossing the Olshanka River. At dawn, the firing let up. Our chaplain gave communion to the troops, who went up from their positions, squad by squad, to the Orthodox chapel, where our Walloon priest, dressed in Feldgrau, that's field grey, joined in a truly Christian fashion with the old Russian village priest in his purple mitre. Their sad and bitter hearts were soothed. Their parents, wives, and beloved children had heard the same Mass back home and received the same Eucharist. The soldiers went back down with simple souls, pure as the great white step which glistened in the Christmas afternoon. End quote. Not that it would surprise any of us, but I quoted this to again show about that this struggle was not against the Russian people, their culture or religion, but against those who had hijacked Russia and were actually suppressing and persecuting the Russians who still clung to their traditional values. And just briefly, what the Walloons found after they had stormed the Bolshevik position shows us again what kind of a mindset this enemy has. Quote, But prior to the final hand-to-hand fighting, the Reds had treated their prisoners horribly. One young SS man had been crucified alive. Another was lying there, his belly and legs brown with congealed blood. The monsters had cut off his sexual organs and stuffed them into his mouth. In spite of the victory, this vision of savagery terrified us. End quote. In early 1944, the Walloons, the Viking division of the SS, and several other German units found themselves encircled by the Soviets in the so-called Cherkasy pocket. Some statistical data to show what they were up against. The Germans and their allies had 58,000 men in the pocket. The Soviets had them encircled with 336,000 men. 59 German panzer against 924 Soviet tanks. 242 German artillery pieces against 5,000 Soviet artillery pieces. Support from the German Luftwaffe was almost non-existent except for supply drops. The Soviets had 1,054 aircraft available. The Walloons and the Vikings would hold lines with only 10 men per kilometer for days. Any breakthrough by the Soviets had to immediately be sealed, and any position overrun had to be retaken or all would be lost. They fought with incredible dedication and bravery. I can only give small examples of this naturally. Quote, "We had to re-establish the line without delay or else face a definitive break in the front, with all the consequences that disaster would bring. I had asked for panzers. Behind them and under the protection of their harassing fire, we might just reach the mill and the crest. But nothing happened. We had to act, confuse the enemy. A few volunteers slipped into the big trench and followed it back up towards the Reds. They were led by Lieutenant Thiessen, a strapping young man, 2 meters tall with a jaw like Fernandel and the mischievous eyes of an overgrown kid. He tossed back all the grenades that the Reds threw at him with ease. A bullet went through his left arm. He carried on, unflappable, and laughing heartily, freeing 100 meters of terrain. Finally, at 1400 hours, the German tanks arrived. There were only 2 of them, but their noisy advance was enough to throw the Reds into a panic. Many took to their heels. We could see them hastily taking down their machine guns, encrusted with the oozing cement of the parapets." End quote. The German High Command, of course, did everything they possibly could to free the men trapped in the pocket. But the panzer division sent to freedom, among them Michael Wittmann with his with the Leibstandarte, had a really hard time even getting there, cutting through the Soviet armies. And so for days without any sleep, they had to keep fighting off the hordes of Soviets. Even in all this chaos and mayhem, the Grell couldn't help but noting what the Germans are known for worldwide. Quote, "In spite of our fatigue, we couldn't help admiring this efficient machine, this command in total control of itself, this withdrawal as regular as the timing of a race. The commissariat, the distribution of munitions and gas, the flow of traffic, the telephone, the radio, everything worked perfectly during these haunting weeks. Not so much as a grain of sand fouled the gears in spite of the concentration of disparate troops, harassed day and night, despite the loss of considerable material sunk in the muddy thaw." End quote. Most of this reputation was probably earned in the years between 1933 and 1945. I don't think anyone would call the Weimar Republic efficient. Well, in the end, they did manage to break out of the Kessel, as the Germans call an encirclement. Kessel means cauldron. Not without heavy losses and sacrifice, of course. Of the 2,000 Walloons, only 632 were able to get out alive. I will end today's presentation with the following quote that I think exemplifies this sacrifice and heroism very well. And next week, the final part with de Grell's last days in the war, how he evaded capture, and what he did after the war. Quote, "The orders instructed the assault brigade Valonia to spearhead the dawn attack that would decide our safety or our extermination. Amid the incredible confusion unleashed by the Soviet tanks bursting in among the last 1,000 German vehicles, we thrust swiftly toward the southwest. Behind us, the noise was deafening. Zandarovka hadn't held out more than an hour. The Reds had already overrun the village. Their tanks were driving forward in our direction for the final strike. The German panzers had been sent to the counterattack as a sacrifice unit, 1 against 10, just like the cavalry of Marshal Ney east of the Beresina a century earlier." He's making reference to the Napoleonic Wars here. Continuing the quote, "I saw them just before they threw themselves against the enemy. The faces of those young tankers were admirable. Clothed in short black jackets with silver trim, their heads and shoulders protruding from the turrets, they knew that they were going to die. Several proudly wore the tricolor ribbon and the large black and silver knight's cross on their necks. A glittering target for the enemy. None of these marvelous warriors seemed nervous or even moved. They plowed up the snow with their treads as they departed through the tangle of the retreating army. Not one returned, not one panzer, not one man. Orders were orders, the sacrifice was total. To gain 1 hour, an hour that might yet save tens of thousands of soldiers of the Reich and of Europe, the German tank crews died to the very last man south of Zandarovka on the morning of the 7th of February 1944. Shielded by those heroes, the army rushed toward the southwest." End quote.
Well, thanks, Messerschmitt. I think that was probably your best one yet. That was really fascinating and really well put across. I expect you're thoroughly enjoying your sip of water after that. I could see you're getting a bit of a dry throat, but I didn't want to interrupt you because it was quite moving the way that you were explaining all of that. Just the first thing I think to look back at from that was the way that the Germans improved the lot of the Ukrainians and the Russians. As the Russians left, as they burned everything with their scorched earth policy, destroying everything, the Germans came up behind and rebuilt everything and put everything back up to a high standard of living. In fact, a higher standard of living than was actually there before. And it's such a shame that we don't actually get told about that. We get told about this brutal occupation of the Nazis, but it can't have been that brutal if there were industries there, if there were named corporations that were advertising. If they were advertising their wares, then there must have been the place must have been flush with money for people to actually spend the money on what was actually being created, which is quite some difference to all the grain being taken away by Stalin from the Ukrainians. I mean, the pictures we've seen of that with the starving people actually having to resort to cannibalism just in order to stay alive. I mean, that's a big difference from that to how life was like under the Germans. And again, I think we can see the unity between the white nations when you see the Catholics going into the Orthodox chapel and holding mass with the Orthodox priest, because there was quite a lot of animosity between Catholics and Orthodox, especially in that area of Europe. So that shows that during the war, the Orthodox were as united with the Catholics as the Protestants were. All three branches of the Christian faith were united in their fight against godless communism. So I think that showed that as well. And the incredible bravery and courage of these men when they're outnumbered over 6-1 in the freezing cold, having seen what these animals did to their comrades, I mean, it's just shocking to hear that. That just reminds me of when you were talking there about them crucifying one of their comrades and cutting the genitals off one of them and stuffing them in his mouth. That just reminded me of the way the Muslims behaved, the Turks behaved, just 150 years ago. The Bashi Bazouk in Bulgaria, they did exactly the same as that. They cut people's arms and limbs off while they were still alive. They impaled people on spikes, burnt them alive on spikes, raped the women before beheading these people. I mean, the tortures that they actually did to these people while they were still alive are just unimaginable, really, for white people to hear. So I think what we have there when we're hearing about these quote-unquote Russian troops that were doing that is that they probably weren't actually Russian. They were probably Mongolian, Chinese, Jewish. And they're obviously taking some relish in what they're actually doing. They're not fighting a war there to save their people. They're just being savages for the sake of being savages. And we know that that isn't something that comes naturally to white people. That comes naturally to Jews and other mongrel-type races. And those are my thoughts on it, Schmidt. And I think I speak for all the listeners when I say thank you so much for all this work that you put into doing these presentations for us. I know I enjoy them, I know our listeners do, and I know Dennis does. Dennis, what are your views on that?
Well, again, like I say every week, he's my favourite general. I mean, the man's made of iron. The bravery shows, which comes off him and his men pick up on, he's just incredible. I mean, he's just an incredible guy. I mean, in such conditions as well, outnumbered, it was that will to win, that will to survive. Of course, that bit of luck and God on his side, but just a tremendous character who Hitler thought highly of and deserved all the luck and that he managed to survive the war. I can't say enough about him. I mean, his stories after, which I've studied on YouTube, are just fabulous and the honesty that he tells it with, especially about speaking about the SS and the bravery. He's just phenomenal. Really is phenomenal. He really is the favourite of all my generals, you know.
The days of carnage in the pocket, however, left their mark on the Walloons. How could they not? The following quote is from a passage right after they had finally seen the first German posts outside the pocket welcoming them. Quote, "After leaving the German forward post at Lysanka, we came to a sunken road. The snow swirled about us, flailed us, cutting visibility down to 1 meter. We settled down as well as we could in the neighboring Izbas. We were still very close to the Soviets. But where could we go in the middle of the night, blinded by this whistling tempest? 50 of us entered a hovel and bedded down there. Every so often someone would jump up, yelling, babbling nonsense, pummeling the air. In the month that followed, I, myself, would have horrible nightmares every night, crying out, striking the wall, the furniture, everything near me with my fists in the darkness. During the 3 weeks of encirclement, I had personally engaged in 17 hand-to-hand combats. For a long time, in my tormented nights, I would see again the grimacing faces of Tatars, of Kirgizes, of Samoyeds, of strangler Mongols against whom I had fought for my life almost every day." End quote. As I also mentioned last week, the Panzer Division, sent to cut through to the Kessel, had met extremely hard resistance, and so it took longer than expected to free the trapped men. They had to push from the inside of the Kessel as well, even though they barely had any ammunition left. When de Grel and his men passed the location where the great battles had taken place, this is what they found. Quote, "As we advanced, we saw what the progress of the panzers coming from the south to meet us had entailed. The steppe was nothing but a cemetery for tanks. 800 Soviet and 300 German tanks had been destroyed during the 3 weeks' battle to free us, which almost had failed." End quote. This may sound impressive enough, but please keep in mind the Soviets there had also roughly 10 times as many artillery pieces, men and airplanes, not just the superior numbers in tanks. A Wehrmacht general found de Grel and told him that Adolf Hitler had already telephoned three times and was waiting for him. They had been looking to find de Grel for 2 days, until they finally did. He was led to a Fieseler Storch, a very light German airplane that we mentioned before in these presentations, and flown to Uman, where he boarded a trimotor plane along with General Liebe and SS Viking Division General Gille. And for the last time, de Grel saw the landscape in which he had been fighting ever since 1941. Never again would he see these lands. They approached Lithuania and then turned towards the Wolfschanze, the Führer's headquarters in East Prussia. I mentioned the vermin problem in the second episode. It was impossible not to get infected with lice in the trenches. And here now follows a little quote that is light-hearted, but in reality, nearly getting eaten alive by these vermins wasn't funny at all from everything I read and can imagine. Quote, I was expected first at Himmler's. In the automobile which drove me from the airport, I could feel hundreds of lice devouring my body. My uniform was filthy. They had guessed at headquarters, occupied only by neatly dressed people, that the wild men of the front like me might want to freshen up upon their arrival. So I entered the bath, where I simmered for an hour like a tough old piece of meat. Himmler had made me a present of a beautiful green shirt that spared me from having to pick up the old one, which, tossed into a corner of the bathroom, was surrounded by a tribe of brave Ukrainian lice, flabbergasted to find themselves suddenly in so impressive an atmosphere. It seems they were talked about for a very long time among the entourage of the Reichsführer SS, end quote. When he was presentable again, Hitler met with him, welcoming him with the words, I have been very worried about you. And this is de Grel's impression of Hitler at that time. He had met him before. Quote, we sat down in wooden armchairs facing a massive fireplace. I looked at the Führer with amazement. There was still the same strange fire in his eyes, direct, bewitching. The preoccupations of 4 years of war had given the man an impressive majesty. His hair had whitened, his back was bent from studying the maps interminably and from bearing the weight of a world, end quote. Hitler personally decorated him with the Knight's Cross, which de Grel had probably earned 10 times over by that time. What made de Grel even more proud, however, was the prestige his Walloons had gained in the eyes of Hitler. He was told that all his officers of the castle were promoted one grade, and 150 Iron Crosses were awarded to individual Walloons. In the meantime, the situation at the Eastern Front had gotten even more desperate, but de Grel and his men received 21 days of leave and would be cheered on as they paraded through Belgium. They were joined by many more Belgian volunteers, even in these days. Quote, the center of the capital was a sea of faces and flags. The panzers could hardly pass among the tens of thousands of people who had hurried to see and madly cheer our soldiers. The crowd tossed like the sea, shouting and throwing thousands of roses. The first, the sweetest and the most tender roses, heralding the bright days of spring. End quote. His children were there as well, and he lifted them onto his tank. Soon after this triumphant parade, de Grel's brother was assassinated by leftist terrorists for no other reason than being his brother. After the leave, the Walloons were sent to the Estonian front. Hitler had forbidden de Grel from fighting at the front, but just like so many others we've heard about, Rudel, Hartmann, Galland, who defied similar orders, he could not live with the thought of being in relative safety while his comrades were dying at the front. He traveled to Estonia then by sea and disembarked at Tallinn, the capital. The people of Estonia were fleeing the Soviets with whatever possessions they could carry, but Soviet fighter planes would attack them and machine gun them and bomb them, these refugees. De Grel saw incredible carnage on the roads. despite the overall situation at the Estonian front, which of course was under threat of total collapse, morale among the Walloons was very high. No matter how many times the enemy outnumbered them in manpower and weaponry. Quote, I decorated our most valorous wounded right on the ground where they fell. Being hit by explosive bullets which blasted frightful holes in them still didn't prevent them from choking and drawing on the cigarettes which their bodies put between their lips, outlined in red blood. These boys were unbeatable. Wherever they were placed, the Soviets stopped. I was deeply moved before their simple and smiling bravery. For if their remarks were funny, it was out of modesty to make fun of themselves at the very moment they were rising to pure heroism. The communists had to be stopped. They stopped them. They didn't let them by on the 21st of August. They didn't let them by on the 22nd either. When our soldiers were relieved on the 22nd of August at noon, the Reds hadn't been able to gain 10 meters of ground north of Cambia. End quote. Degrelle himself, as Dennis said last week, set the example and to inspire his men. And on one occasion, he would climb on the parapet of the trench he was at and stand erect while the machine gun bursts were passing him on all sides. For 5 hours, he was on that parapet, marching back and forth, encouraging also the German and Estonian soldiers nearby. In another passage, he wrote that at the front, as implausible as this may seem, the brave are less likely to die than the fearful who do not dare to raise their heads. After those 5 hours, everything seemed to be lost, however, as 13 Soviet tanks with a lot of infantry support approached their position. He had asked for reinforcement several times, but nothing had happened. And then, when the tanks were only 30 meters away from them, the Stukas appeared in the sky and saved the day yet again, scattering the Russian tank column. I extremely shortened an epic which would deserve to be told in full. That very position was very crucial for that part of the front which shielded so many Estonian towns from the Soviets. For that very action, Hitler awarded him the oak leaves to the Knight's Cross. At that time in Estonia, Degrelle encountered quite different types of Soviet units. Some were made up of child soldiers with barely any training, given a submachine gun and prodded to the front. At another occasion, the Walloons were faced by a battalion made up of criminals, convicted murderers, set free and armed with shaven heads. The Walloons were again horribly decimated in these battles, and when the order came once more to hold a position no matter what, even non-combat Walloons would join the fight. Everybody in the upper command knew the Walloons would hold the line, and the courage of his men brought tears to the eyes of this man of steel. Quote, I had no one left but the walking wounded and the office personnel. We rushed to Maria Magdalena along beautiful blue lakes sparkling with all the fires of the summer, insensible to the rout spreading alongside. I wanted only volunteers. All our brave old comrades of the administrative services came forward. For that matter, what use was there for an administration at the moment? The accountants closed their ledgers. Legionnaires more than 60 years old, who had been cutting sausages and counting loaves of bread since 1941, left their cleavers and their books to take up Panzerfausts. Their quiet courage brought tears to my eyes. All our wounded who still could walk lined up in front of the rectory. Of the only two officers left to me, one had his arm shot through by a bullet, the other had been hit by a grenade in the chest. But both stepped to the first row of this heroic little troop, end quote. And incredibly, the Soviet offensive there in Estonia was brought to a grinding halt. As part of the explanation on how this was possible, Degrelle offers this, quote, the German forces were numerically weak, but of a very high quality. The infantry units, now skeletal, were scattered like us, and like us, exposed to brutish assaults. admirably operated heavy equipment seconded us. The battlefield of Dorpat was littered with the blackened carcasses of Soviet tanks. The enemy's armored units were completely scattered and disorganized. That counted for a lot, the defeat of the Soviets. End quote. The Grell was again summoned to Hitler and received not only the oak leaves to the Knight's Cross from him, but also the Nahkampfspange, or close combat clasp, in gold, which is only given for 50 or more close combat actions. Many German infantrymen valued it even higher than the Knight's Cross. It was on this occasion, as again Dennis mentioned previously, that Hitler said the following words to him, quote, "Just as he was leaving, as if he wanted to engrave a more personal remembrance forever in my heart, Hitler came back and took my hand in both of his. If I had a son, he said to me slowly and affectionately, I would want him to be like you. I looked into his clear eyes, so sensitive with their simple and radiant flame. He went away under the first by roads strewn with twigs. I looked after him for a long time." End quote. And then next, the Grell was sent to Belgium, his home. He witnessed how British and American bombers destroyed any Belgian town which could serve as a passage for the German counteroffensive, sometimes called the Ardennes Offensive. Even farms and tiny villages were bombed and machine guns from the air. Many Belgian civilians died in the rubble. In fact, this is what stopped the offensive, according to the Grell. The German panzer columns and all the other units could not advance anymore. It was during these days that he also met Otto Skorzeny, who had just been wounded and also had taken part in the battles there. The Grell sent out scouts to inform himself of the situation in Belgium and what news they brought back made his blood run cold. As he wrote, quote, "The reports of our freed comrades made our blood run cold. They described to us the savage treatment that thousands of men and women throughout Belgium had been made to endure in the name of democracy. Incarcerated in abominable conditions, cheered at, beaten, tortured, loaded down with infamy because they had different political ideas than those of the, quote, liberators of September 1944. End quote. Women of racist families were actually raped and their children taken away to be put into mental asylums and prisons. A fate that would also befall the Grell's own children. And this brings me to the final part of the presentation. I had to skip over many noteworthy passages. The Grell would still see combat in the defense of the Reich, near Berlin, for example. But near the very end, Himmler advised him to go to Copenhagen and regroup his soldiers there, the few he had left. Himmler told him, quote, "You have been faithful, you and your balloons. You were the last to stay by our side through the fighting and misfortune. One day Germany will remember." End quote. Once in Denmark, however, he saw that the situation was not safe. British transport planes were already landing at a Danish airport. German Navy officers helped him to sail to Oslo, and from there he was able to board a plane and fly to Spain. There was not enough fuel for the passage, but somehow the pilot made it to the Spanish coast, where the plane crashed and Tigrell was severely injured. The Allies were furious that he managed to escape, but Franco refused to hand him over. In fact, Franco handed over a lookalike while allowing him to escape from the hospital. And then later Spain granted him Spanish citizenship under the name José León Ramírez Reina, and Spanish nationalists helped him with a career in a construction firm. The post-war Belgian government condemned him to death by firing squad, but they could not get to him. Instead, they punished his innocent wife and children, as I said before. Even his parents were thrown into prison. They died there, as well as his wife. But the Grell was actually, over time, able to free his children. I haven't been able to find an an actual detailed report of this, but I'm guessing that he had several contacts across Europe and especially in Belgium, and was able to free his children from these mental institutions and horrible prisons that they put them in. And de Grel famously said before his death of natural causes in 1994, when asked if he had any regrets about the war, he said, "Only that we lost." And yes, I have come to the end. I hope you enjoyed these five parts of this absolutely amazing man.
Very much so. He's absolutely incredible. I mean, that's so sad that they went after his children and his parents. I mean, what have they got to do with anything? And why persecute someone just for having a different political ideas to the rest? It's not like nationalists wish to persecute other people for their political ideas. We like to have, you know, the free exchange of ideas. All he was trying to do was the best for his people, and he supported the regime that was in power. The Germans were in power. They liberated Europe from the grip of the bankers. I just find it sad that once the Allies actually came in and took those countries over, there wasn't more of a resistance against them. And they were really after Leon de Grel. They wanted him put in the Nuremberg trials at the Kangaroo Court there. They were desperate to get hold of him, so he did amazingly well to get away. And you think, how many people are there that survive aeroplane crashes? I mean, that's a serious stroke of good luck that he had there to survive, and they obviously hated that, so they went after his children and his parents, and they went after the children of the other German heroes during the war. One of the bits that really struck me there, Schmidt, was the fighting in Estonia against the Soviets, so that they could let the Estonian refugees get out from before the Russians actually came in there. And the Estonians today, they still honour their war heroes over there. There are some quite famous battles that only because of these battles and only because of them holding off the Soviets, there was a large percentage of Estonia were able to actually get away. The legion that they had, there were different legions in the Baltic states, the Estonian legion, the Latvian legion. There wasn't a Lithuanian one, but they were still armed, I think, by the Germans. And the Russians to this day, they don't want the Baltic states to honour their heroes that fought against Russia during the war. But that was all that they were doing. That was all the Estonians were doing, was fighting against the communists. That was all that their legion was actually doing, the Waffen-SS there. They weren't fighting against the Allies, and yet still they're told that they can't honour these heroes. There are a lot of people turn out for that, and there's Ruben Kaalep, part of the Conservative People's Party of Estonia. I think they've got 11 members of parliament, something like that. But he's quite proud to wear his SS badge that he wears, and the people there are proud that their ancestors laid down their lives so that they could get away. And you think there's Leon de Grel, and he wasn't Estonian. He was from Belgium. He was a Walloon. And he was there fighting to save his racial kinsmen, not to save his people from his nation, but another European nation, and to save them from the communists. And that's what it was all about. It was all about these European nations getting together to fight against communism. Only, unfortunately, we had Britain and America fighting on the side of the communists, which is such a tragic thing that we still have to try and get over today. Dennis, would you like to make a comment on that?
Yes, well, I didn't think I could admire the bloke any more than I did, but I actually closed my eyes as Mr. Smith was talking and pictured the scenes, and there's a couple of striking points. One was the fireside chat he mentioned, when he could see that the fires were still burning in his eyes, even after 4 years of war, which was significant to me. And obviously the battles to save the Estonians. And then at the end, the cruelty of the Allies to go after his family and persecute him, and his parents die in prison, his wife die in these prisons, where I'm sure they were mistreated, because history shows now that you know, the Jews took over these places and wreaked revenge, or if you like, you know, retribution. And but he managed to save his kids, which was great to hear. And it was also nice to hear that he actually died of natural causes. And obviously Franco couldn't get involved in the war, which probably saved him as well at the end of it all. But I mentioned last week in the documentary, he sent 50,000 Spanish soldiers who went into the Soviet Union with the Axis powers. So was indeed a supporter of the regime and looked after Leon de Grel to the very end and protected him, which I'm also grateful for.
It's good that he was able to actually stay in Europe as well, instead of having to flee to Argentina or to Egypt or any of these other countries around the world. He was still able to stay in Europe. But that bit about the lice, that was quite entertaining of him to actually write that, with his Ukrainian lice and seeing where they were once he was taking his bath. But that makes you think about these conditions, you know, when they were at war. They must have been crawling with these creatures, these parasites. They must have been so pleased that there was this Zyklon B chemical which could actually get rid of these lice, get rid of the lice from the clothing, fumigate the sheets, and get them clean. You know, what a travesty to make out that this life-saving chemical was actually used to gas 6 million Jews, when this life-saving chemical probably saved the lives of 6 million people by being used against these typhus-bearing lice.
Can I just add to that as well? I forgot to mention the fact that Hitler took his hand as well and said to him that, you know, if he'd had a son, he'd wished him to be like him. Must have been one of the great moments of his life, I would imagine.
Yeah, you think of that being reflected today with Obama saying that if he had a son, he would look like Trayvon.
Exactly.
It's like the total opposite, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, that was fantastic, Messerschmitt. You know, lots of people say how much they enjoy these presentations of yours. I know a lot of work goes into them. Have you got anything else that you'd like to add to that before we move on to Dennis's piece for the week?
Well, concerning these Soviet fighter planes strafing and machine gunning these refugee columns, this is not some isolated incident. This also happened in Germany, from the Germans fleeing from the eastern portion of the Reich. And they also, I know one incident where they actually ran over with tanks over these refugees, completely crushed them. So this is, what the Soviets were like under the leadership that we know they were under.
And the shooting of the torpedoing of the ships as well. Were the Allies involved?
Yes.
We know what the Allies did after the war. They turned the people around that had surrendered to them and handed them straight over to the communists, the Cossacks and people that had been against Bolshevism right from the very start. They surrendered to the British people, and the British people just handed them straight over to the Soviets, and there was that famous massacre that we were talking about earlier, Dennis, wasn't there?
At Blueberg, yeah. Which I'll probably do a talk about next week if given the chance.
Yeah, I think it would be good to go into that. We've got Croatian in the chat room that I know would like to hear more about that. Yeah, it's so sad to hear these stories, Messerschmitt, but it does bring it to life. It does bring these characters to life, and as Dennis says there, you know, you can close your eyes and imagine it all happening.